gravity though. A Yagi will give you all of the performance it's supposed to if each of the directors and reflector are the right electrical length and in the right position. That's what the Yagi really is. It's a bunch of parasitic elements that have the right electrical length in the right position. You do that and the Yagi's going to have the pattern you care about. That's where the gain is coming from. The second criteria you care about is that the driven element should give you a good impedance match and a low standing wave ratio and radiate in a dipole-like manner. Well, as long as the driven element is set up like a dipole, it's got no choice but to radiate like a dipole. And whether you feed it with a gamma match, a T match, a folded dipole, a delta, whatever your favorite method of feeding a dipole is, that's not changing the Yagi design. Go and do that. However, what does it take to make the dipole have a perfect impedance match if that's what you want? You'd like it to have a 1.05 standing wave ratio. You can make the driven element perfect without detuning the Yagi. It's very tempting to start fiddling around with the length and position of the first director, or fiddling around with the length and position of the reflector in order to improve the standing wave ratio of the driven element. Very tempting to do that. And at first it seems effective, but you're changing the Yagi design. You're changing the way it focuses RF energy. You're changing the pattern when you do that. You're letting one adjustment contaminate the other. You don't have to do that. If you go to Tom Williams' website, and his website is www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, W-A-1-M-B-A, whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. You go to the very bottom of his webpage, which is intended for microwave ham radio operators. But you go near the bottom of this page, you'll see an article entitled Yagi Impedance and Matching Info. The elements, length for the J-Boomer. That's the second half of it. But Yagi Impedance, Matching, and Info. You go there. You'll find an article that I've written that's a little bit verbose. It goes on for two or three pages. It will tell you everything you want to know about getting perfect impedance match to the driven element of your particular Yagi. Once your Yagi is really starting off with somebody's known good design, and you put your favorite driven element on it with your particular materials and your particular feed line, and get a one-to-one match, then you're going to get the greatest chance of this whole system flying for you. And then you can run the experiment of aiming the Yagi in various directions, possibly changing the altitude of the Yagi, and after that it's onward and upward. Back to you, Charlie, if you need any fill on any of that. KC2MPY, K2LIW on the deck mat.
Okay, Dick, thank you. I've got that web address. I'll certainly take a look at that. Definitely read that article. Definitely. I want to know that information. I have an MFJ-269 here. It's one of the first toys I bought a couple years back when I first got my license, and I thought that would be real useful, and it has been. And using that, this antenna from 144 to 148 is 1.2 SWR, and I thought that was pretty good. And it took a little playing around with, and I think I had mentioned to you that it's actually... it's a gamma match type thing, I guess they call that, and there's a capacitor that couples that to the driven element, the dipole element, and it wound up with like 15 picofarads in there, and that's what I've got, and that's what I'm going to try, so we'll see how that works out. KC2MPY.
Okay, that's another good way of doing it. If your MFJ-269 is well calibrated at your particular frequency, and you can always check it by putting it into a known dummy load or a pair of dummy loads on a T connector. A dummy load should give you no reflective power. A pair of dummy loads on a T connector should give you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. A pair of 50 ohms in parallel makes 25. That should have a 2-to-1. So now you've got a way of checking the calibration of your standing wave ratio indicator. And now you've got a way of checking it on two spots on the dial, 1-to-1 and 2-to-1. And if it gives you anything reasonable or something that you can offset, so to speak, mathematically, then you know exactly what you've got. In the case of a gamma match, where you move the length of the gamma match rod and change the variable capacitor of the gamma match rod, you've got two independent adjustments there, particularly if you do that with a telescoping type capacitor as a gamma match rod. And some people do it with a fixed variable. And you got to worry a little bit about weatherproofing it, because water on those capacitor plates are going to change its capacitance a whole lot. But those are minor details. You're trying to make it work first, and you'll make it pretty later, and make it thoroughly weatherproofed even later yet. So with the instrumentation you've got the ability to make that match as good as you want. 1.2 to 1 is way inside of the requirement. Anything beyond that is gilding the lily, but maybe you're a perfectionist and like doing that. If you enjoy it, go for it. Anything below 1.5 to 1 on 2 meters is fantastic. A 2 to 1 standing wave ratio on 2 meters, the average guy would lose a lot of sleep over that. It's half a decibel loss from an ideal match. 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, half a dB of loss. A 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, I think it's 2/10 of a dB. Very difficult to see that difference. So sounds like you've got it made. Let's see now. The first Bob said he had no questions. Second Bob we've handled. Charlie we've handled. And I think those are the people who have signed in so far. Let me double check on that. So far, so good. Paul, would you like to give us a little bit of report as to what's going on in space? And let's see now. The last I knew, the space shuttle landed in California. We have to spend the 1.5 megabuck or whatever it is to move it to the vertical assembly building in Florida. And they're going to be flying it over a couple of day period on that great big 747 specially equipped airplane. And I know that I've read somewhere that I think it's Opportunity, which still has a good right-hand wheel, is about to dive into the... Great big crater on Mars. About to dive into the great big crater. And they're worried about whether or not it's going to be able to get back out of there. So give us a few words on that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW on the deck net.
Okay, Dick, very good. The space shuttle did go to California, so they do have to bring it back to Florida on top of the 747, and they'll get ready for the next mission, and which is it's going to be a different shuttle next time. The Opportunity, that's now at a crater called Victoria Crater. It's a very, very big crater. You know, it's when they landed this thing, 3.5 years ago on Mars, it landed right in the middle of a little crater called Eagle Crater, and they considered that a bullseye. They thought this was great because the crater is dug in and it's got all this outcropping, and you can go to these rocks that are sticking out of the side of the crater. And depending how deep you go, how deep the crater is, you can go back in time and evaluate these rocks, and it just did that for quite a bit of time. And they consider themselves very lucky on winding up in this crater. Spirits didn't wind up in a crater. Spirits is on the other side of Mars. It wound up pretty much in the middle of nowhere compared to what Opportunity did. Now, the years have gone by. In the 6-mile trek, landing, it went to another crater called Endurance Crater, which was bigger and deeper. So they were able to get out, more information, actually go further back in time. And it spent, a year there riding around, and they were worried about Opportunity getting out of that crater. It finally did. And now they march on, and for the last, half a year, they've been trying to figure out where they're going to go inside this other crater, Victoria Crater. And Victoria Crater is big. It's a half a mile in diameter. Maybe 6 times bigger than the Endurance Crater, which they thought was pretty good. It's got to be, 500 times bigger than the original crater, Eagle Crater, that it had landed in. So now this thing that's a half a mile wide and very deep, they'll be able to get a lot of information to go further back in time because it's deeper and figure out what Mars was like billions of years ago, whatever it is, compared to the two previous freighters. The problem is going in, they believe they might have a lot of trouble getting out, but they'll spend the rest of the time exploring the thing. They can go from one wall to the other wall, and if they lose it, they'll lose it. It's worth the gamble. There's nothing else really nearby for opportunity to investigate, so they're going to give it a shot. And if they can't get out, they can't get out. It was only supposed to last, what, 3 months or something, and here it is almost 4 years later. So it's doing good. It does have that one right wheel problem that is still not working. The similar problem occurred with Spirit, so they tend to drag it along. They get this high current reading, and they can tell that the oil is not getting to the wheels. You know, the oil lubricates all these mechanisms. You know, you've got six wheels on the rover, four of them which are drivable, and they have to have soil that's forced down into the joints. It's a synthetic oil. It's a special oil that's been developed over the years for the type of robotic equipment, deep space equipment, and even the International Space Station. They always use the same type of oil. And apparently it's not, you know, it's not getting to where it's going, and the motor is giving them trouble. But they're gonna work it out. They're gonna continue with that. And Spirit is doing very well. They now have like almost 800 watt hours of power. You might remember a couple of years ago the panels were getting dusty and dirty. And there were recommendations, maybe they should have had a brush on top, some kind of a blower, and that would have added to the expense. They thought it was only going to work for three months. You don't need any of that kind of equipment. Well, what happens once in a while, there is atmosphere on Mars, and the wind comes along and blows the dust off the panels. That happened with Spirit, and that happened with Opportunity a couple of years ago. But since then, it's been degrading. Well, lo and behold, last week they had another little wind that came by, and it's really cleared off the panels on Spirit, and they're back up to almost 800 watt power, watt hour power worth of energy. You know, you can run 8 light bulbs, for 100 watt light bulbs for an hour, you know, it's quite a bit of power, and they'll be able to recharge it day in, day out there. So I wanted to mention that, and I just wanted to mention the Dawn spacecraft. I've been transmitting a long time here. Back to you. I'll mention the Dawn spacecraft that's launching next week. K2RIWWS.
Yeah, I want to hear about the Dawn spacecraft. Also, when you go to the right website that I've seen during the week of what the Victoria Crater looks like, my goodness, that looks big, scalloped, deep, deep. Looks like a wicked place to go when you see the photograph that's on the Wright NASA website. It looks like a kind of a Grand Canyon that they're about to go down into, except for the fact that it's got a rather large flat floor, many, it looks like hundreds of feet down, maybe it's even a couple thousand feet down, some kind of a bedrock floor. That crater looks like it's been the impact of an extremely large meteorite some number of millions of years ago, and that meteorite got right down to the bedrock, and so they're going to be able to look quite far back in time when they go down there. And getting back out could be pretty risky. I could tell by looking at the appropriate website where they show you the paths that were left in the sand by Opportunity, going around the edge of this crater, looking at all the edges, looking for the right place to go down in, and now they've looped back. So I think they call it Botany Bay or something like that. They give it a name to a place where they're about to dive in. And they may never get back out, but they think that the risk is worth it because it's near the end of the life of the unit, and this is where you're going to get the real pay dirt if we really get down there and start making some good measurements. I think the rock abrasion tool is somewhat damaged. You might mention that to me. So maybe it's not giving full performance these days, but still we get some good data out of it as I see it. But when you go to the right website, you'll see a very dangerous-looking crater that this thing has been skirting the edge of for the last couple of months, and it's about to dive in. So it looks like an exciting mission. So go ahead with your information, Paul. WS2M, K2LAW on the deck now.
Okay, Dick, I didn't know that the rocket operation tool was having problems. I guess it's getting worn out. It's got a few diamond bits on there. I know, but the opportunities of the ape had trouble with the motor early on. And they weren't able to sew it properly. And they set it differently than Spirit when they go from place to place. Because they don't want to wind up getting this thing stuck in the wrong spot. I think the motor has maybe a dead spot or something on it or whatever. So that's the only problem I ever heard with the arm on that. And as far as information, if you get the best website is from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It's MarsRover.jpl.nasa.gov. And that came out right from the beginning. I've been looking at that website on and off for years now, since the flight of these two spacecraft. So that's a good one. You don't have to put www. You just put MarsRover.jpl.nasa.gov, and that gives you immediately the history and current status of both Opportunity and Spirit. Real good site. Instead of going to NASA.gov and navigating your way, you eventually wind up there anyway. Put it in Google, you go to MarsRover.jpl.nasa.gov. As far as the Dawn spacecraft, that's going up on the 7th, 777, of this month. So that should be nice flight. To watch the three-stage rocket, the Delta II rocket. Three stages, got 9 solid boosters on it. It's the biggest of the Delta-class rockets. When they launch it, they can launch the Delta with less solid booster rockets on it or whatever. It's just, big time. They want to go out to the asteroid belt. By the time they get out there, it's going to be 2011. I think I mentioned a little bit of this last week about the Dawn mission. It's going to visit the asteroid Vista and Cirrus, and not only visit, it's going to orbit one and then leave and orbit another one. This is going to happen 1, 2, 3. It's going to get out to the first one in 2011, and when it leaves Vista to go to the other one, it's going to take another 4 years. So the mission will actually be over in 2015. How much fuel does it have on? It's got plenty of fuel, but it's not regular chemical fuel. I mean, it's got that too. But this is one of these ion spacecraft, the ion propulsion engine. It comes on and stays on for hours and days on end with slight thrust on it. I mean, very slight thrust. And I've heard it described as, the amount of pressure a paper clip pushes down on a 1 foot piece of paper or something like that. Very, very little thrust, but it stays on like forever, and they're able to eventually accelerate and get to where they want to go with a very light spacecraft, because you don't need all the chemical propulsion on board to do that. And they've done this in the past with a couple of other spacecraft, but they're really getting pretty far with this ion development with the engines. So I thought I'd mention all of that, and hope for a good launch on the 7th of this month for the Dawn spacecraft. Back to you, Jim. WS1.
Which means next Saturday, I think it's the 6th of July. So for people who have got satellite television, that should be a fun thing to watch. NASA Select or NASA Contract Channel, as it used to be called. That should be a little bit of an incentive for me to fix the power supply on my satellite system, which has failed and needs replacement. Thank you for the space report, Paul, and good work. Mel, I bet you've had a couple of emails Mel and I were together last weekend, the weekend of Field Day, which I think was last weekend. Yes, he mentioned it last Sunday night after the Field Day was over, but the two of us were so tired, I don't remember what we said. We probably said things we shouldn't have. Anyhow, my guess is you've had a couple of emails, depending on how many of them you want to go through. There's not a whole lot of them. There's another subject that somebody called me up and would like to discuss. So over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now this is K2KEY, why you keep you busy good part of the night with the emails here. I'm just going to read them over and pick out one here and one there. It's up to you, Dick, if you want to tackle. I got some real pile of them here, and like I say, we could just see which ones we're interested in discussing over.
Well, you choose, Mel. Start at the top and choose what you think is an interesting one that has general interest, and we'll go from there.
Okay, here's one, in fact, that came in here and is actually apropos to what we were just discussing. It comes from a young person, and he said, I know you discuss things about space. I saw a movie, and they showed that this killer asteroid was coming towards the Earth, and space shuttles landed on it, blew it up. Is that practical right now if we knew if an asteroid or one of these things going to hit us in a short period? Can we do anything about it at this point? This, I guess we could ask. I don't know. What's your opinion, Dick? And maybe Paul got some comments on this. Over.
Yeah, if you go to the website, which I think is called spaceweather.com, I think that's the website. Not only does it show you where the sunspots are, gives you a little bit of astronomy each day, it changes each day, the message, and about three articles down on the first page, it shows you all of the near-Earth asteroids, the near-Earth grazing objects that are now known, and I think right now there's going to be one coming by the Earth somewhere around the year 2035 or something like that. It's going to come within a couple of lunar distances. They measure both in astronomical units, that's the distance between the Earth and the Sun. They use that as a yardstick, and when things get real close, they use the distance between Earth and Moon as a yardstick, and they call it a lunar mist distance. And so if you have enough information about a space object that has an intersecting path some number of years in the future, and you go out there, you don't have to blow it up. You may only have to move it, 4 inches per second, new velocity in some direction. And if you're smart enough in the way you can predict orbit, that means it'll miss you for the next 5,000 years type thing. So very little steering is required if the information is given early enough. And where the Dawn mission, among other missions, are starting to visit asteroids and other pieces of space junk, let's call them, and drop weights into them and analyze the debris that gets blasted out of there. The actual impact that we did, I can't even think of the name of the spacecraft, Paul will tell us, I guess it was last year, we intentionally sent a piece of hardware to impact and impact. What was that again, Paul?
Deep impact.
Okay, deep impact. So the deep impact mission, we intentionally sent a piece of hardware to crash into it, and we stood off with another piece of space hardware that took some careful pictures of what the debris was, and by analyzing those pictures, you figured out what was below the surface of the asteroid, yes. So a situation like that would steer it into a slightly new orbit. Whenever you impact it with something, you're slightly steering it. So Newton's first, second, and third law dictates what goes on here. Action-reaction is one part of the situation. An object left alone tends to move into a straight line. Well, that's if it's not acted on by anything else. All of these objects are being acted on by the solar gravity and some of the planetary gravity, and they all have a predictable path if you know with any accuracy where they are today. So impacting these things, steering them, you don't have to blow them up. That's much too severe. It makes nice science fiction movies, and you send all your favorite actors out there, your old actors, to act in those movies, and it makes a fun movie to watch. But scientific accuracy is a little bit lacking. And so a minor amount of steering, a very small velocity change in the proper direction, is all that's required to create a huge miss some number of years downrange. Very similar to what the Dawn mission is doing with its ion engine. The ion engine is giving a flea power type thrust, but it's doing it with extremely high accuracy. The accuracy with which a rocket engine operates, we call it specific impulse. And so if you can use a very small amount of matter coming out of the rocket engine, but you send it out at extremely high velocities, you've electronically, with this ion engine, accelerated things to a good fraction of the speed of light, therefore with very little mass expansion, with expending very little mass, you get a lot of potential thrust out of the thing. And so you turn on this ion engine and let it run for a year at a time, and accumulates a whole lot of delta velocity, as opposed to using a rocket engine where you get tremendous amount of force out of it, but you only do it for a few seconds. And you get a lot more efficiency out of the first operation than the second. But you better be accurate with where you aim it, because you're going to be doing that for a long period of time, and that better be the direction you want to go, because changing your mind later on with an ion engine is very difficult. As long as you've got enough fuel on board, changing your mind with a rocket chemical engine is a lot easier. So, to answer your question, is it possible? Very possible. NASA is now collecting as much information as they can as to all the objects out there that potentially could hit us. And what do you worry about? You worry about one that's in the vicinity of 100 meters in diameter. If it's about the size of a football field, and if it comes at us at a high enough velocity, it can do something like Meteor Crater in Arizona. And Meteor Crater in Arizona took place a lot of millions of years ago. If it took place today, it would drastically disturb our atmosphere. It would temporarily give us something you and I would call a nuclear winter. It would put so much dust in the atmosphere in the process of that thing diving in and doing its thing that our weather would be heavily disturbed for a long period of time. The total amount of solar energy hitting the Earth would be drastically decreased, and a lot of crop failures would occur. A lot of food would no longer be available in certain portions of the world, and a lot of very cold winters would take place until the atmosphere finally settled down. So it is something to be concerned about, and the hardware is now being developed that can do something about it. K2KEY, KQRIW in the second half.
Okay, Roger, very good. This is K2KEY. Okay, so at this point right now, let's say one of the objects that we don't know about all of a sudden we discovered has come out of nowhere. I think there may be ones out there now that we haven't looked at that can sneak up on us. And we were given a short time, say, a matter of a month before it would hit us. Is there anything that's been planned immediately that could be, in other words, can we really now take a space shuttle or whatever and do something within the next, say, month if we have to, Dick, over?
I think the answer is no, for about two or three reasons. If we discover an object that's going to give us an impact, let me pick a number, 5 years from now, and we start dedicating our resources to send a rocket out there to push it into some other direction, just give it a small delta velocity so it misses us for the next 40 orbits, so to speak, that would be doable 5 years from now. If you've only got a couple of months' notice, the hardware has not been built, the contract has not been set, the space shuttle can only go in very near or Earth orbit. If you use every single drop of fuel that the space shuttle can ever have packed on board, you can't get above 600 nautical miles above the Earth's surface. We've never been more than, I think, about 300 miles above. So 600 is the absolute maximum. The Earth has a radius of 4,000 miles, and you can only go 0.6,000 miles above 4,000. As you can see, I don't know what the exact number is, maybe it's 15%. You can only go 15% or something like that of the Earth's radius, maximum altitude, with the space shuttle. The asteroid we're talking about is millions of miles away, not hundreds of miles above the surface of the Earth. So shuttle can't get you there. In some of these science fiction movies, the shuttle does get you there. That's crazy. The shuttle, an extremely heavy craft with a lot of capability, a huge payload bay that can lift something as big as the a Hubble Space Telescope. It was literally designed to lift an object as large as the Hubble Space Telescope into orbit. That was its original design, maximum mission. So for what we're talking about here, you wouldn't be using the shuttle at all. You'd be using an expendable rocket. It'd be a multi-stage rocket, in my opinion. Solid boosters and liquid boosters and whatever, some kind of a combination, in order to deliver a payload that does its thing. Now, I'll bet you Paul has probably read some more articles and did a little more study on this. Let's see what Paul's got to say. What do you believe is the amount of lead time required, Paul? WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I was going to say the first thing out of my mouth was when Mel and Keith was going to be, no, they don't have anything yet as far as I've ever read. They do worry about that scenario that Mel brought up, though, that this youngster wrote in, because you've got, 100,000 identified asteroids that are over 500 feet, I think it is. So there's 100,000. There's probably many, many more, of course, that they haven't discovered yet or kept track of in the asteroid belt. What happens? Jupiter goes by, and its gravity tends to move these asteroids. Sometimes it pushes one to the outer solar system where it disappears, and sometimes it pushes one to the inner part of the solar system. And so we wind up with another near asteroid that joins the rest of them. There's a website that you can go to. I'll have to find that. But there is a website that you can. It's got plotted thousands of these different near-Earth asteroids going around the Earth. And one, of course, six, which you were talking about, is Apophis. I think that's 2028, it's supposed to come near us. And then they're worried that the gravitation of the Earth is going to change its orbit a little bit. And the next couple times around the Sun, I think 2030-something, 38 or something like that, it could come even closer, maybe even from the Earth. That's the latest on the process. And if it did that, we would do a scenario like you laid out before. You send unmanned rockets up to a spacecraft like that and probably land them on the asteroid and fire the rockets at a certain time when it, these things are all rotating. You can't leave the rocket on it, and you'd have to cycle it. It's going to have to. You want to push it in one direction, so you need complex engines to be able to come on and off and do something like that. Blowing them up is no good. It tends to wind up with billions of particles coming down hitting the Earth instead of one big one. There could be more problems. You could be creating more problems. Solving with that. The only possibility I've heard that you could do on a short-term burst basis, let's say one comes out from around the Sun that we haven't tracked, we didn't know about this, you could launch a nuclear rocket right nearby and blow it up near it, right near it, not blow up the asteroid, but blow up the right next to it, or maybe even a comet, which is, of course, even more unusual than a comet would hit Earth. But both items, hopefully you'll be able to do something to the path of it at that point, but highly unlikely, and that's why I also say no to that. So one of the biggest questions Carl Sagan used to talk about is, once you have the technology to move these things around in space, one might want to go out and bring one and put one in orbit. You might want to maybe mine the asteroid and get something out of it, or bring it to a different location to bring the water-filled little moons and put them into a different orbit somewhere, so you could have now water in a different near another planet. These bizarre things have been planned. But the technology, once the technology is there to be able to move an asteroid or a comet or whatever in space, that means as time goes on, other nations might also have this capability. And Carl Sagan worried about some rogue nation, you know, somebody that maybe was looking to bring on the apocalypse a little early, you know, take everybody with them, maybe 100, 200 years from now, you'll have a nation that would be able to, you know, they'll be in space too. They might go up there, and it might be, it's probably more likely that a rogue nation would go up there and move an asteroid to hit the Earth instead of going away from the Earth than it is that an asteroid would probably hit the Earth of a big size, because they go by statistics. The last life-destroying asteroid that completely almost destroyed everything on Earth was that one, 65 million years ago, that landed in the Yucatan Peninsula and took out the dinosaurs and everything else. Although that had a plus side. It eliminated all of them, and maybe that allowed humans to walk the Earth. So, you know, give us a chance to screw it up. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, what's going on here, Mel, as I see it, is that NASA is now developing better and better space telescopes, ground-based telescopes, and so on, in order to search for these objects. Anything more than 50 or 100 meters in diameter is what we're concerned about, and to find objects that small requires very sensitive telescopes and the right kind of a search program. So the hardware is being developed to find all these things so that we've got the forewarning and therefore stand a chance to do something about it. And I think a good guess right now is that anything becoming near, it's going to take a few decades to happen. The way Neil deGrasse Tyson, the man who is the head of the Hayden Planetarium.
Neil Tyson,
okay. He has told us that we're going to be hit again. Earth has been hit many times. It's just a matter of time. You take, for instance, approximately 10 years ago, the Shoemaker Levy 9 object, which struck Jupiter, made some great big blemishes on this huge planet called Jupiter, and it broke into pieces before it hit. Had that not been absorbed by Jupiter, and at some number of orbits downrange that hit Earth, that would have been pretty serious. There are people predicting that to have a nice Goldilocks location for your particular planet around the Sun, not too close where it's too hot, not too far away where it's too cold, just right, is one of the conditions required for life. Another condition is to have a couple of extremely large planets like Jupiter and Saturn to act as sweepers to collect an awful lot of the great big pieces of junk that would have hit us. And they take the hit. They're gaseous planets. They don't really care. They can take it. We wouldn't like that. So we've got the right combination here, and there's a certain amount of built-in protection. But still, the Earth has been struck a number of times before. Well, lucky for us, it occurs over very long periods of time. But it's just a matter of time before it's going to happen again. Let's hope the next time we're prepared to do something about it. K2KEY, KQLIW on the TechNet.
K2QIW.
QIW, start up with your name, sir, and then your question.
Yeah, hi, my name is Joe, and I'm from KQEY2QIW. My question is, I had problems a couple of days ago with my radio. How's my audio now?
Rather good. Just the right amount of audio, nice clean audio. In fact, it's a sharper sounding audio than mine. Joe, go ahead.
Okay, what I did was, outside from the outside building over here, I just changed the connection. I have a male-female connection that I had to change. I guess it got wet when we had the rainstorm, or I thought maybe lightning struck the antenna.
Okay, you're sounding very good. Lots of carrier, dead full quieting, and good audio. You got it made. So back to you, Mel, K2KEY.
Okay, very good. It says K2KEY. Yeah, sounds like, I could say, a situation that eventually we'll have to really be serious about, just in case one of these objects begins to decide to pick us out as a target. And It's you know, a situation. I know. I remember that that when that comet hit Jupiter. Gee, that was something to behold. Really, that was a really something that, you know, you never expect in your lifetime to see actually a collision like that. As Vic said, that would be a major catastrophe here on the Earth. What was the last meteorite that they know of? Let's just stay on the subject one more time to have to think of something. The last meteorite, when was the last, you know, major meteorite? I don't know if you can call it major. I guess there's small ones hitting us all the time somewhere. But any consequence, one that you'd say really could have been a major disaster in modern times. When was the last one that really, you know, did any real damage that that they know of, Dick, over?
Yeah, the most recent one I know of is the so-called Tunguska event, which took place in the Soviet Union around 1905. I don't know the exact year, but that particular meteorite, I don't know how big it was. Maybe Paul's got an estimate of it. When it hit a very barren area, an uninhabited area of Tunguska, Russia, I think it leveled a couple of square miles of trees. And that was an extremely hot re-entry of that object. It did not leave a crater. Just the pure heat and blast of it hitting the atmosphere and coming down as far as it did leveled a couple of square miles of trees. I bet you've got a that's the most recent thing in recorded history I know of. When it comes to the Meteor Crater in Arizona, I think it is, when it comes to the Yucatan Peninsula event, and there's a similar event up in Canada they've recently discovered, all of these were a good number of millions of years ago. I don't know the exact number, but I'll bet you somebody has published a report saying that a significant hit on the Earth takes place once every 50,000 years. I'll bet you there are estimates in that order. And so you probably haven't had a hit for 50,000 years. Does that mean we're due? You got to be careful how you judge that. It's very similar to sitting in front of a truly fair roulette wheel, and black number one came up now. Does it mean black number one is not going to come up for 50 more rolls? Probably you can't say that. Paul, what do you know about the Tunguska event, and when, from your reading, is the most recent major Earth impact? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. 2008 was the one in Russia, Tunguska. That blew up and completely disintegrated. I think they said 5 miles above the surface. Pretty high up, and it leveled everything. It took them years to get in there, the scientists to get into the area, because, you know, back in those times, in 2008, you know, what kind of equipment did you have to get there? So it took them years to get in there to investigate, and they found all these trees down, and they interviewed people that lived there, and you could see the way the trees were laying down. From that information, they were able to figure out the angle that it came in at 30 degrees, pretty sharp angle. And they estimated the size to be 300 feet, 300 foot diameter. I think somehow they figured that out by the blast and all, years and years of investigating this thing. So I expect you to a rough idea of something that's only 300 feet could cause that kind of damage. They said if it had hit London, it would have wiped out the whole city. It was that kind of a blast. If you get something a mile in diameter or 6 miles in diameter, like the one that hit, that wiped out the dinosaur 65 million years ago, I think they said that was 6 miles in diameter. You know, that's a big one. Before that, I think it was 250 million years before that one. that they had a real major blast. So these things are very well spread apart, and that's why I say it's hard to really think of what's hitting and wiping us out, because the odds are against it. And that's why the chances of maybe moving one around or trying to move one to try to mine something out of it and accidentally doing something wrong and having a crash into Earth is probably more likely than just rolling the dice and waiting for something to hit us. I definitely wouldn't lose any sleep over waiting for one of these things to hit. Now, they say 400 tons of this stuff, meteors, hit the Earth every year, 400 tons. And that's all these things in the sky at night, collectively over the ocean. That's what it adds up to. You know, some of them, of course, make it to the ground, but most of it burns up into the atmosphere. They say we're adding 400 tons of weight to the Earth every year just from meteorite day in, day out. You know, it's going on 24 hours a day. You know, just because it's daytime, that doesn't mean things aren't happening up there. So it's just collective over time. That's a lot of weight, 400 tons. Back to you, Jeff.
Sure is. The Earth has experienced, by the fossil record they discovered, the Earth has experienced something like 5 total mass extinctions. In other words, some kind of an event has occurred roughly 5 times in our 4.5 billion year history, which has wiped out major portions of all the life form on the Earth, and it got started all over again. So you could say that on average, once every 60 million years, something like this does occur. There's reason to believe that the frequency of these occurring is slowly decreasing. In other words, the sun has already swept up much of the junk that's left over in this particular solar system, so there's less and less of it available to hit us. But possibly once every 50 million, 60 million years. It reminds me a little bit of the story of when Edward Teller, one of the inventors of the hydrogen bomb, was giving a lecture, and he was talking about the sun, and he said that the sun will last a total of 10 billion years, and it's now approximately 5 billion years old. So there's 5 more billion years left to the sun's life. And the story goes that a lady in the back of the room said, Mr. Teller, did you say 5 million years with an M or 5 billion years with a B? And he said, I said 5 billion years left to the life of the sun, 5 with a B, 5 billion with a B. And she said, oh, I'm relieved. And so it's sort of one of those kind of situations. I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it, but NASA and ESA, European Space Agency, are developing the hardware to detect all these things, because to ignore it would be a little bit foolish. The hardware has multiple applications. It's good astronomy hardware that allows you to find exoplanets, that allows you to investigate our solar system, our galaxy, and so on. So we're getting multiple benefits from developing the hardware that gives us the ability to investigate all these orbits and find out which ones are potentially a hazard. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I'm looking on a beach, looking for a piece of that rock that may fall out of the sky. So far, I haven't had any luck finding it. Love to have a little piece of a meteorite, something from another world. And so, then the weather gets cool, you know, nobody's on the beach. Here I walk along the beach with my metal detector and everything. And according to what the program that they had on PBS, this guy was finding all kinds of meteorites, some of them somewhat large. Found one that showed one, that famous one he found that he got quite a bit of money for. Weighed 700 pounds, he dug it up. And he's able to detect it with a metal detector. And when he dug it up, he showed he just put a magnet up against it and it stuck to it. So I would assume they get a high iron content to these stones, Dick, because otherwise I don't know how he finds it with a metal detector to begin with. All right, very good. Any further words on this before we do a live tackle something a little bit different?
And that was a beauty. Hit us with another one, Mel. And roughly how many emails did you get this week?
Oh, I'd say there's quite a number from here. I'm just skimming over them. I'm just not going to bother even answering a number of the ones that we basically covered quite a bit of detail. You can find on an amateur TV that was recorded. And if they want to look back on those or things that I don't think really for us to make much in the way of comments about political situations, even though maybe they affect communications, I think it's not correct to really get too deep into anything commercial here on amateur radio. So if you'd like, let's see, we've got some kind of questions here, and maybe you want to tackle stuff for you.
In 2MD.
Let's go for a few antenna questions. Barry recognized, and what Mel was just mentioning is the fact that there is a website where a very enthusiastic man in New Jersey has recorded years of the SICKNET. This is Mike Perry, KC2NJI, and approximately a year's worth of the SICKNET is now available by going to www.amateurradio.tv. That's it. www.amateurradio.tv. All run together. There's a double R between amateur and radio. And it's .tv. Not .org, not .com, not .net. It's .tv. Amateurradio.tv. You go there, and once you learn how to navigate that website, you'll find out that Mike has documented each 5 minutes, so to speak, of the TechNet, what subject is being discussed, what date it was being discussed, what reel number it's on. I mean, the TechNet is typically 3 hours long, and so these are in one-hour reels. So you go to the right date, the right reel, and he'll tell you how many minutes into that reel that particular subject is being discussed. You go there, and you listen to that audio of Mel and I discussing these subjects, and the other people who signed in and gave us all the extra information. It's not extremely high fidelity audio. It is a nice compacted audio so that the website can contain it all. And a number of people have given me feedback, very favorable feedback, saying they really love this. See what N2 Moon Bounce has got to say. It looks like we're into space a little bit here tonight, as well as antennas, Barry. What would you like to add to all this, or what question have you got there, Barry? N2MB, K2LIW.
Yeah, how you doing, Dick? Okay, I was actually on the telephone at the same time, and I just want to bring up a little something. It's sidetracking, I think, but we can discuss it later if you wish. You had made the comment, and this is something I find to be a little fascinating. You said that I forget what you said. I think you said 50,000 years since the last major impact struck the Earth. And probably a lot more than that before the biggie, the one that took out the dinosaurs. You did this, and you said statistically, this is what strikes the Earth. I have a problem with statistics. I've been wrestling with this for quite some time. I think we should view the statistics from the reverse direction and find out that they are very predictable. Statistics are almost an energy source of their own sometimes, you could think that. If that's the case, and we are, let's say, 1,000 years overdue for the next big hit, if that was the case, I'd be looking for a helmet. no, not really. But why do I say this? Well, for instance, you take some things that we use as standards, like rubidium, and we measure the amount of electrons that leave the rubidium standard. And this is a random event. These things take place purely randomly. However, if you measure the flow coming off the rubidium, you'll find out that is an extremely predictable number. Statistically, it's a very predictable number, even though it's a random event. So clearly is this a predictable number that this is the most accurate way to keep time. So I think if you are, say, playing the stock market, whatever you're doing, if you're long overdue for an event, even though there's nothing out there that says the event should take place now, I mean, logically, in our minds, we say, yep, that's true. I would take a look at the other statistic. What are the chances after the event time has passed that you will go another 50,000 years without the event taking place? I think you'll find that to be a little bit shocking. K2RW N2MB.
Okay, Barry. I can tell your rig was used in the sideband mode recently. Your audio was a little bit heavy. Not as heavy as it's been in the past. Good, clean audio, though, by the way. A lot more high-frequency notes than I've got right now. I'm gonna work on this microphone. I did say 50,000, and I should have said 50 million. 50 or 60 million years is the approximate spacing between major impact events on the Earth. So 50 or 60 million, M for Mike, million years is the approximate number. And is it a regular event is a darn interesting question. Yes, in the case of rubidium and cesium, using them as a standard oscillator for timekeeping is an extremely accurate object. And so when you integrate each of those cycles coming out of the rubidium or the cesium for a long enough period of time, their long-time accuracy is extremely high. Their short-term accuracy, and that's what you're talking about, the difference between short-term frequency accuracy and long-term frequency accuracy. Short-term, they're kind of sloppy. There are crystal-controlled oscillators that are higher in short-term stability than rubidium and cesium. So the best possible atomic clock would be cesium for the longest term, which is then being used to discipline a crystal-controlled oscillator, which is giving you the short term. And then that way you get the best operation. So the crystal-controlled oscillator is a variable-controlled crystal oscillator, VCXO, being disciplined in the long-term drift by cesium. And that's the oscillator used by the National Bureau of Standards, as it used to be called, NIST as they're called today. And I think they're measuring accuracy or frequency of one part in 10 to the 14. That to me is a lot of accuracy. I think it's approximately 1 second per 10 billion years or some number like that. Not to worry. That clock doesn't lose time very fast. And that's the clock that determines whether or not we insert leap seconds in the clock that gives you the WWV clicks. On either June or December, we insert a leap second periodically because we used to use the rotation of the Earth as a standard for time. But there are years in which the solar event is a little bit more significant. It puffs out the atmosphere a little bit more. The Earth has a little bit of higher moments of inertia, and the Earth spins a little bit slower, and you lose a second during that year. And so in order to make everything turn out right, between the diurnal clock and the sidereal clock, National Bureau of Standards, NIST, inserts a leap second periodically because we now got something more accurate than the solar system and the Earth itself. Kind of interesting. So, but when it comes to random events, you got to be careful. If I've got a single deck of 52 cards and I really randomly shuffle those cards and deal out all those cards and look at all the cards one by one, and I do that event by shuffling the whole deck and dealing out the whole deck and looking at what comes out in what order, without a doubt, the ace of spades is going to come out once every time I use the whole deck. So that's an extreme predictable event per total deck dealing. But is the ace of spades going to come out in the beginning, card number one, or the end, card number 52, or somewhere in between? That is thoroughly non-predictable. So in long-term accuracy, I can predict how many ace of spades you're going to see when you shuffle the deck and use the whole deck 50 times. But where in each individual shuffle is going to happen, I can't. So you've got an event a little bit like that when it comes to asteroids hitting us. You may say on average, you're going to get an event once every 60 million years, M with a mic, 60 million years. But is the next one going to occur 5 million after the first, or 105 million after the first. That's not so predictable. N2MB, for some further comment, K2LIW.